Aristotle, Part 2, the 13th talk in a series titled The Bible and the History of Ideas, was presented by Jack Crabtree on February 6, 2013, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The handout mentioned in this talk is handout number 5 in this series.
We finished B5, the history of the influence of Aristotle and Plato. Plato was the philosopher for the first major portion of the Middle Ages, and then Aristotle becomes the philosopher for the medieval period for the rest of the time. And I think both of them, I mean, the impact that they have on Christianity largely overlaps. Aristotle continues the influence of a lot of Platonic ideas. Aristotle, as we will see as we go through here, has a lot more to offer than Plato does if you're a medieval thinker and a medieval philosopher, because he wrote so much and was such a creative, productive mind. He gives all kinds of intellectual tools for people to use, and that's why he gets taken up by Aquinas and the Scholastics, because they use the resources that he gave them to do their their theology and their philosophy. But those tools don't really have much of an impact. I mean, they don't one way or the other either. I mean, if anything, it's positive. It gave them the tools that they could use to articulate their faith, their doctrine, their worldview. The negative impact of Plato and Aristotle doesn't come through that. It comes through their cosmology, their metaphysics. Those have a negative impact on Christianity. But the tools that we'll see that he hands them is really neither here nor there. They're good as far as it goes, and they get improved on later in the history of ideas. So any questions on their influence before we go to logic?
So on 5B, where you say Aristotle adds some of his own unique influences, are you going to talk more about what those are?
I just did.
Okay.
It's the tools.
So not in any necessarily more detail than that?
No.
Okay.
Well, as we go through, I mean, logic is one of those, and that's
okay,
our next
topic. So you're
going
to expand on those as we go.
It would be nice if I could take this home to Gail, who's not here tonight. She was going to ask the question, what are some present-day readily identifiable instances of Platonism or Aristotelian?
Okay, I actually just start to make a list, and I don't think I brought it with me. Let me do this. Let me bring that next week because I get asked that enough, and it always catches me off guard because I haven't prepared for it. So I need to do that. I'll start next week with that. Okay, logic. We talk about Aristotelian logic. It is not uncommon by people who know a little bit but not a lot to say something like Aristotelian logic is outmoded. We don't believe in Aristotelian logic any longer, or something like that. Well, there's a sense in which that's true. Technically speaking, that's true, because technically speaking, the only formal logic that Aristotle talks about and that he formulated is what we would call syllogistic logic. And a syllogism is a argument form. You have a major premise, a minor premise, and a conclusion. And all of the premises take the form of either all A is B or no A is B, some A is not B, some A is B and some A is not B. Those are the only four legal allowable statement forms in syllogistic logic. Now, you'd be surprised how much you can say in that in that statement form. If you've ever read Lewis Carroll, you'll run into syllogisms that make incredibly complex statements using those forms. But those are the only legal statement forms universal affirmative, universal negative, particular affirmative, and particular negative. Only four legal forms. Then there's only three terms allowed, A, B, and C. That's called the major term, what they call the middle term, and the minor term. So in the syllogism, look at the first figure there. All M is P, all S is M, all S is P. Notice that the form of the argument, the M that's in both premises drops out of the conclusion, and you're left with only the other two. So one of those, and I'm not fresh enough to remember if this is a fixed, which one is which, but you have the major, in the conclusion, you have the major premise and the major term and the minor term show up in the conclusion. Yeah, the premise that included the major term is called the major premise, and the premise that included the minor term is called the minor premise. So a major premise, including the major term and the middle term, minor premise, including the minor term and the middle term, and then the conclusion includes the major term and the minor term. Okay, if it doesn't have that form, it's not a syllogism. So do we use syllogistic logic today? Not much. You'll have a chapter on syllogistic logic in a Introduction to Logic book, textbook. You'll have at least one chapter or two chapters on syllogistic logic. You'll learn Venn diagrams, which was a device developed later to help you determine the validity of syllogisms. And then you're done with it. And then you go on to other forms of logic. So in the sense that syllogistic logic is not really all that, well, it's alive, but it's not well. It's alive, but on the verge of dying. It's not a very viable formal system for doing argumentation and judging the validity of arguments. It could be, but syllogistic logic is to logic what Roman numerals are to arithmetic, basically. I mean, you can do calculations with Roman numerals, but good luck. You can test the validity of arguments using syllogisms, but good luck with that. I mean, have fun. Because it gets incredibly complex and tedious and cumbersome. It's just not very efficient. So in that sense, Aristotelian logic, if what you mean by that is syllogistic logic, is that outmoded? Yeah, that's outmoded. But normally, when you hear the criticism where, well, Aristotelian logic is outmoded, they mean something more significant than that. And what they mean by that is any logical system that believes in the validity of the law of non-contradiction, for example, because at the heart of Aristotle's system was the law of non-contradiction. A cannot equal not A at the same time and in the same sense, we could add. But A does not equal not A. That's critical, that something is what it is and it ain't what it ain't. And that it's important to start there. If you don't start there, then your whole view of reality is going to be really different and really warped. But in the right kind of context, you'll have all kinds of modern people wanting to challenge in one way or the other the law of non-contradiction. And people like me who insist on the law of non-contradiction, we're just being, what are we being? Truculent. There you go. We're just being truculent. An example of, you mean a name or a...
No, an example of
quantum physics.
Yeah, I was in a conversation once with somebody, and basically, well, usually what they'll do is appeal to the Eastern mind, that the Eastern mind is not like the Western mind. It doesn't think in terms of contradiction. It doesn't think in terms of either or. It thinks in terms of both and. You'll hear that every now and then, that the Eastern mind wants to embrace the truth in contradictory opposites and affirm them both. It doesn't want to split them off from each other and choose one over the other. Yeah, you hear that not infrequently. Well, I don't know that much about Eastern philosophy, but I know enough about it to know that that's kind of a caricature of Eastern philosophy. There's a sense in which that kind of thinking makes its way into Eastern thought, but that kind of thinking makes its way into Western thought too. I mean, when we get to Hegel, it's not really unlike anything Hegel would say. But Hegel has not abandoned the law of non-contradiction. He's just saying that above and beyond our normal, everyday, common sense logic, there's this thing being played out in history that involves thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. And when we get there, we'll talk about that. But he's not really negating the law of non-contradiction. And I would submit, I don't think that's what's happening in the East either. In the context in which they don't fully affirm the law of non-contradiction, they're very particular kinds of contexts. And even if they do philosophically, even if you can find branches of Eastern philosophy that just out and out deny the law of non-contradiction, what does that prove? Because the reality is that the Chinese rice farmer believes in the law of non-contradiction just as thoroughly as the Kansas wheat farmer. I don't care what the philosophers are saying. I know more about wheat. No, I don't. I pretend to know more about wheat. It is not the case that it is both raining and not raining at the same time. It just doesn't work that way. And every wheat farmer knows that. You know, he doesn't perceive reality outside the limits of the law of non-contradiction. He just doesn't. He's a human being. So when people are rejecting what they call Aristotelian logic, and what they really mean by that is they're rejecting common sense intelligence. That is, they're saying, well, common sense intelligence is fine if you want to be a Westerner. Common sense intelligence is fine if you want to do technical stuff and science and engineering and stuff like that. But when it comes to the really important matters of our existence, the law of non-contradiction just doesn't cut it. And you don't have to be commonsensical. You don't have to be intelligent. You don't have to be rational in the conclusions that you reach. That's an entirely different claim than claiming that logicians don't use syllogistic logic any longer. So the distinction clear? Because often what they'll do is they'll make a true claim. Logicians have passed Aristotle by in logic in order to support a very untrue claim, and that is that logicians have now countermanded the law of non-contradiction. They've rejected that and are going on to build logic on something else, on a different foundation. Well, that's not true at all. Clear enough? Too technical? Do you want me to? I gave you some examples of syllogisms. All M is P, all S is M, therefore all S is P. I don't remember why he calls that the first figure, but that's what Aristotle calls the first figure of a syllogism. Might be more understandable without the letters. All animal is a substance. Every man is an animal. Therefore, every man is a substance. That's a valid syllogistic form. Basically, so the way syllogistic logic works is you could make, 128 different combinations of major term, middle term, minor term, using it, cast them into the form of a universal affirmative, universal negative, particular affirmative, particular negative. I think it comes up to 128 different combinations that you could put together. Some of those are valid, all the rest of them are invalid. And what I mean by that is, by valid I mean if the premises are true, then the conclusion is necessarily true. That makes it a valid argument form. So only some of the forms that you could possibly create legally of a syllogism, only some of them will be a valid argument form. So the way syllogistic logic works is that it takes your argument and casts it in the form of a syllogism, and then it asks, is this in the form of a valid argument form or an invalid argument form? If it's an invalid argument form, then the argument is invalid. If it's a valid argument form, the argument is valid. So that's how it works. So these first, second, and third figure are examples of three valid argument forms. All P is M, no S is M, therefore no S is P. Every man is risible. Do you know what that means? K capable of laughter. Every man is risible. No horse is risible. Therefore, no horse is a man. That's Aristotle's example. So in the third figure, every man is risible. Every man is an animal. Therefore, some animals are risible. So all three of those are valid argument forms. And when you put it in actual English, it's pretty evident they're valid.
No, if the form is valid or invalid.
Well, what Aristotle has done is he's... Good question. How did he get there? The way to do it, and I don't remember if this is actually the way he did it in his writings, but you could... Let's just make up a syllogism. No A is B. All B is C. Therefore, some A is not C. And I don't even know whether that's valid or not, because I can't remember what I just said. But just because I can legally make a legal major premise and a legal minor premise and a legal conclusion and state it in a legal form doesn't mean that I've actually constructed an argument that makes any sense. Now, what Aristotle's appealing to is just our common sense. I mean, this is not stuff that we don't know. Every 5-year-old is learning this and is employing it all the time in everyday reasoning. So Aristotle is not creating this. He's not making this up. What he's done is he's mapped our ordinary common sense intelligence into a game, if you will, a model, a kind of game or a model. And lo and behold, this game or this model so accurately models the way we engage in deductive reasoning that we could go through all the legal possible forms of the syllogism and pick out the ones that our common sense tell us, well, that's valid, that's valid, that's valid, that's not valid, that's not valid, that's not valid. And then once we've decided which ones are valid, now we have a tool that we can use, because all we have to do is look and see if it's in the right form of a valid syllogism, and then we know it's valid. Now, you're asking, well, how is that helpful? Because didn't we have to use our common sense to decide whether the argument was valid anyway? Yes, but we can use our common sense on simple syllogisms where it's really clear. But what if you have a very complex syllogism where it's not at all... It can get so complicated that your mind gets all tied in knots and you don't know if it's valid or not. Well, let's reduce it to all P is M, no S is M, therefore no S is P. If I can convince myself that it has that form, even if my mind can't immediately see using English that the argument is valid, I know it's valid because it has the right form. So that's where it becomes a useful tool.
I think my question was coming from making the assumption that all syllogisms were valid because those are the ones we think about. But if you take all the multiple combinations of those terms, of course they're not all valid.
Right, right. I mean, just think of some A is B, some B is C, therefore some A is C. No, that wouldn't be valid. But yeah, but the main thing to recognize is that all Aristotle is doing in logic is reflecting the way the human mind just works naturally, kind of natively. He's not telling us think this way. I've invented a way for you to think this way. He's just reflecting the way we do in fact think and always have thought and always will think. Can't really help ourselves. It doesn't make any sense to think any other way other than in the deductive logic that he's trying to capture with his logical system. Now remind me, I want to come back and tell you where logic goes after Aristotle a little bit, but let me come back to that. So formal logic, now one of the assumptions in Aristotle, and this is a huge assumption, is that formal logic, or at least the common sense intelligence that is captured by formal logic, is analogous to, or is equal to, is identical to, the rational structure of reality itself. So that's a really interesting thing when you read Aristotle. It's sometimes hard to know, are you talking about the way reality is, or are you talking about the way we talk? Well, for Aristotle, there's no real appreciable difference. The way we talk is a description of the way things are. Now, he's probably a little on the naive side about that. He has not taken care to make a distinction between the form of language usage that we use that is directly derived from our observation of the way things are and some elements of our language usage that don't necessarily mirror or reflect the way things are. Because I think our language uses both kinds of devices. So Aristotle has not made that distinction. So he just basically has this fundamental underlying assumption that let's analyze the grammar and syntax of our language. And the grammar and syntax of our language is a reflection of the way the world is organized and structured and put together. Well, that's a very important assumption in both Plato and Aristotle. So there's this correlation between thought and reality. How we talk about, describe, and reason about reality is just how reality is. Well, this is the pillar that undergirds what will come to be called rationalism, or what people in the history of philosophy call rationalism. It's that perceived connection, that assumed connection or correlation between how we think about reality and how it is. So, I mean, to me, it seems a little silly, but if you believe that, then it doesn't seem so silly to think, if you want to know something about the universe, sit down in your armchair and contemplate what would be the rational way for reality to be. Well, if you can really arrive at what the rational way for reality to be, then given this, the Platonic Aristotelian assumption, well, then that's the way reality is. Because reality mirrors rationality and vice versa. Now, I think rationalism to that extreme is false. And I think that basic assumption that thought mirrors reality is to a certain extent true, but not true enough to base all your conclusions on that.
So if two different people sit down in two different armchairs and contemplate how reality is and come up with two different concepts, are there two different realities?
No, one of them would accuse the other one of being wrong, and then they'd fight about it.
So Aristotle would still say there is one truth.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm sorry. I do need to make a distinction. In this postmodern era, reality reflects rationality because reality is my rationality. They're not postmodernists. They simply think that the structure of the human mind and the structure of reality itself have the same source. For them, it's from the one mind, from the one, the good, the beautiful, the rational, that the one who's the source of all things. Since both derive from the same things, they are correlated with each other. That is not unlike what I think is a biblical assumption. I mean, the biblical assumption is God created the universe, and God created me to be, among other things, a knower of the universe. Well, how is it that I was created to be a knower of the universe? By giving me a mind, a rationality, that constructs its model, paradigm, picture, whatever word you want to use, I construct my understanding of the universe in keeping with the same rational principles that undergird the actual reality of the universe itself. So when I construct my mental picture rationally, I really am getting in touch with the way the universe really is. Well, that I think that's fundamentally a commonsensical notion, and ultimately a biblical notion as well. I think Plato and Aristotle, it's only a matter of degree. My sense with them is they just emphasize it to a degree that distorts it, because especially Plato, because you lose sight of what they probably don't ever really say, but where people go with it, is there's only one rational way for the universe to be. Well, no one said that. I mean, rationale, there's a little bit of room in rationality for there to be several different rational, completely in keeping with rationality, but different from one another, ways of doing the universe. So how are you going to know if one of 12 different things would be equally rational? How are you going to know which way the universe actually is? Well, you got to go look and see. So you need empirical data. You need empirical evidence. Well, which way is it? The other would be logically possible, but it doesn't look like that's the way the world is. Well, what rationalism does is it tends to lose sight of that, and it thinks if my construction of my system of reality is logical, then that's the way it is. Well, but if it's not, it's not. Hegel is famous for having predicted on rational grounds the solar system has to have 8 planets. And at that point, I think they only knew of 5 at the time that he wrote that, if I remember correctly. But he predicted there have to be 8 planets in the solar system. And it just irritates me that he's right. Sort of.
Did any of these guys go to their grave as pure rationalists?
Plato and Aristotle?
Any philosophers? Did Plato and Aristotle do that? It seems at some point as they got older, they would have went out and they would have had some kind of construct, went out and realized that it didn't work and then abandoned their...
I don't think it's possible to be a pure rationalist in the way that I've defined it, where you're just expecting that all you have to do is logically deduce how the universe is. The heyday of rationalism was in... you have 3, Descartes, Leibniz, Spinoza. Those 3 are the big names at the apex of rationalism in the modern era. And interestingly, all of them did experimentation as well. Mm. So it's not like they didn't seek empirical data. They did. The difference between them and the empiricists, their contemporaries in Britain, was more a matter of emphasis than any real significant qualitative difference between them. Okay. Then the next point, Aristotle engages in a thorough systematic analysis and description of the elements and principles of logic and reason. He was the first and most important logician in the history of ideas. And I understand what I'm saying by that. People have been using logic since time immemorial, but the first logician, the one who studied it and analyzed it and tried to map it onto a formal system, was Aristotle. Formal logic has been improved in a variety of ways since Aristotle, but very little has been supplanted or rejected. Virtually nothing has been supplanted or rejected, but the tool of logic has been worked on and improved. we'll talk about this probably later this term, but the group that immediately began to improve on it were the Stoics, the Stoic philosophers. They did a lot with logic. And what they did is they moved away from syllogistic logic to what's called propositional logic. And in propositional logic, it's way more powerful because it's way more flexible. That in propositional logic, you just have, take a letter to stand for any statement that you want to make. The statement can be as complex as you want it to be. It can be as simple as you want it to be. It can be as complex as you want to be. But you let A be that statement. And then you have another statement. It could be as simple as you want it to be or as complex as you want it to be. And you have B be that statement. Now, the question is, what's the relationship between A and B? And there are 4, I think, relationships. You could form another statement, A and B, and now you have a larger, more complex statement that's the combination of A and B. Or you could have A or B, or you could have if A, then B, or you could have not A. And actually, of those 4, only 2 are necessary. And computers are based on the logic that you only need 2 of those statements, and you can say anything you can say anything you want to say and reason through anything you want to reason through, capture the rationality of anything with 2 statements. Or is it 3? Must be 3. Yeah, I mean you need not and or. And they even talk about in computers, I believe, an AND gate and an OR gate in the architecture of a computer. So that goes all the way back to the Stoics, basically, is working with and developing that kind of logic. That's called propositional logic. Eventually, like in the 19th century, they add to that then predicate logic. And predicate logic is usually used in conjunction with propositional logic. But in predicate logic, you start exploring, like if you had the large capital P, and then you had a small letter at the bottom of the P and another one at the top, and X and Y, where one of the X is predicated of Y. So you can start talking about for all X, if X is larger than Y, so that your predicate is larger than, for all X, if X is larger than Y, then, and then whatever you want to say. But that introduces a new subtlety into logic, and that's called predicate logic. Aristotle didn't explore those. Those were invented after him. But again, the same thing is happening there that as with Aristotle. They're not creating anything. They're not inventing anything. They're just finding a way to reflect the way the human mind reasons. Always has reasoned that way, always will reason that way. And everybody does it, not just smart people. Everybody reasons using this kind of logic. It's just second nature to us. Okay, I'm done with logic, unless you have some questions. You still counting planets?
I'm counting nine planets.
Well, what are you calling Pluto?
I'm calling Pluto a planet. Is that the one we threw out?
That's the one that they've decided it's just two moons doing the do-si-do. One of the things to keep in mind about logic is that it comes second nature to human beings as human beings. Sometimes people will challenge that, and they will challenge that on the basis that they take these logical puzzles to other cultures and see how they will answer and respond to a logical puzzle. And I wish I could remember the examples I've read, but something like in some African village, Tito is a tax collector. Tax collectors are such and such. Tito is such and such. And then you ask them, is that true? And they'll basically say, oh no, Tito's a good guy. No, he's not like that. But the problem is not that they don't reason the same way we reason. They don't know our games. You see what's cultural about that? Formal logic is a game that you have to learn to play. And in that game that you play, you have to get rid of all the extraneous information. No background information. I mean, it's the very nature of the logic game is that you are not going to use any information that is not given you in the premises according to the rules that we have to learn in order to know how to play the game. Well, if you don't know how to play the game, you bring in all kinds of extraneous information and answer the question and respond to the question out of all that. But it's not because they don't know how to reason the way we reason. It's because they don't know how to play our game. And I would submit that if you could teach them how to play the game, they would come up with the same answer that we do. All right, moving on. In D, various important doctrines or concepts in Aristotle's metaphysics and physics. Aristotle, not unlike Plato, thinks that wisdom is true philosophy, which is true knowledge of ultimate reality and the ultimate causes of reality, ultimate cause of reality. But he also had important concepts of substance, attribute, and matter. And those become very important for centuries in philosophy. So it's helpful to know what he means by it. What's critical is to know that what he means by it and what we think those words should mean are not the same thing. That's where it gets very confusing to read Aristotle, because they'll translate something as substance. I mean, don't you think of substance as like stuff? Substance is stuff. That's not what he means by substance. What he means by substance is a particular individual instance of being, more like what we would call a thing. So he means something that is a definable, determinable being. is a substance. So this table is a substance. I am a substance. The chair is a substance. They are discrete, identifiable beings in reality, and that's a substance. See how confusing that is? Because that's not what our ears hear at all.
We think of as a substance that is not a thing. Can you give an example?
Well, something like water is a substance, and we don't necessarily mean a particular body of water. See, a lake might be a substance, but water, wherever
so
you find
it. So it has to have
definable. Yeah, it's a discrete, determinate, unitary body or thing. Okay, then there are different kinds of substances for Aristotle. Primary substances are non-sensible, that is, they cannot be grasped with the senses. They are immaterial, they are eternal, they are unchanging, and they are motionless. And motion, being motionless and unchanging, is virtually the same thing for Aristotle. That is, if something turned colors, it could be sitting perfectly still and turn color, and Aristotle would consider that motion. Okay, so what he means by motion is just any kind of change at all. So change of location, obviously, is motion, but any other kind of change is also motion for him. But the primary substance don't change, therefore they're motionless, they're eternal, they're immaterial, and they're nonsensible. There are three primary substances: God, or the One, or I think I will eventually talk about the unmoved mover, that's one and the same being, the one and the same substance. So God, the intelligences of the spheres. So in Aristotle's cosmology, everything from the moon in toward Earth is, for him, the Earth is at the center of the universe. And the circle of the moon is a major transition in the cosmos. Everything inside the circle of the moon is corruptible, decayed, impermanent, has a lot of not being in it. And beyond that, beyond the moon is the eternal realm. Everything out there is eternal. Well, those ongoing circles in the cosmos are the spheres that have associated with and connected with them basically a mind. So that's what he calls the intelligences of the spheres. And that's what makes the stars and planets move, are those minds. And then the intellect in man is a primary substance. So my body is a substance, but my mind is its own kind of substance, and it's a primary substance. So in eternal, immaterial, nonsensible, unchanging, motionless. It's not a brain. It's not an organ that you can dissect. The mind is an invisible reality that allows me to know things. Then you have sensible but eternal substances, sort of a halfway intermediary, and those are the heavenly bodies, the stars themselves. You can see them, but they are eternal. I don't know if it was in this context that I commented. One of the things that began to make the Aristotelian view of the cosmos implausible was when they invented the telescope. Because when they got a good look at the moon through a telescope, it was just a rock. Well, it's supposed to be eternal. It's not supposed to be a rock. It's supposed to be this eternal being that is of a qualitatively different kind of thing. So that began to call into question the whole set of assumptions in Aristotle's cosmology. Okay, and then finally, the third kind of substances are sensible and perishable. And that's what is in the sublunar realm. All those sensible, perishable substances that exist in and around us in this realm. Well, in this kind of substance, substance is made of a combination of matter and form. And by form, he means Platonic forms, the atomic forms of Plato. The table is a table because it is informed by the form of tableness. Matter, I'll come back to that in a second. matter doesn't mean matter. I mean, don't, just like substance doesn't mean substance, matter doesn't mean matter. Matter is not stuff. It's not molecules. It's not anything that we have been trained to think of and use the word matter to describe. The best way to think about matter, I think, in Aristotle is to consider it pregnant nothingness. I think we talked about, did we talk about this with the pre-Socratics at all? Did I? There's really two kinds of ways to be nothing. If I'm inventing these words now, but blank, sterile nothingness and pregnant nothingness. Blank, sterile nothingness is there ain't nothing there, and there's no way, no how there ever could be anything there. It is blank, sterile nothingness. Pregnant nothingness is there ain't nothing there, but you just wait and see. Something might come to be there. Because it's not without the possibility of there something being there. So matter is the possibility of something being for Aristotle. So notice it's nothingness is what it is, but it's nothingness with the possibility of being somethingness. That's matter. The best way to think of it is space, is empty space. Empty space is Aristotle's matter. There may be nothing there, or there may be something there, but the fact that there's the possibility of there something being there makes it not blank, sterile nothingness.
So does that mean there's one matter, that there's just, or are there possibilities, or is there more than one kind of matter because there's more than one kind of thing that could possibly be there?
No, just one kind of matter. In fact, he calls matter pure potentiality. That's all it is.
So is that why you relate it to space?
Pardon me?
When you relate it to space, are you relating it to what we think of as outer space or just space?
No, just
okay.
All space everywhere. Yeah.
Okay.
All space everywhere. Space is, as we know and experience it, space is the possibility of something being there, of something existing there. Well, so if you like in outer space where there really literally is nothing there, that would be Aristotle's pure potentiality because there could be something there. You know, if we hit it right with our spaceships, something is going to be there one day. Well, then there was the potential, but only potential. Nothing actually is there, but there's the potential for something being there. And pure potentiality without any actuality is Aristotle's definition of matter. So again, do you see, don't even think that it's connected with our concept of the word matter. It's not that at all.
Is nothing some kind of a category of being because it's defined and because it has isness? So is nothing really nothing it's not the way we think of nothing?
Well, nothing is not Aristotle's term, that's my term.
Okay.
So yeah, if you try to understand Aristotle, that's not even relevant to his.
Yeah.
But I'm just trying to get our minds around his idea. What his language is, matter is pure potentiality. Well, what does he mean by that? He means the possibility of being, but no actuality of being. So there is nothing being there actually, but there's the possibility of being.
So is the term nothing really an equivalent term to what he means?
To what I mean?
If I say nothing with potentiality, is that exactly equivalent?
Well, I think so, in the way I would use that word. I think so.
Okay. And then as a separate, just as a philosophical question, can nothing exist and still be nothing? I mean, that's confusing to me. It's hard to imagine a universe where nothing actually exists because as soon as I identify it and I say it exists, it has existence.
Right.
And it seems to lose nothingness, at least in the way that I think about nothing.
Right.
I know. Does it make a sound? I don't know.
I think we probably equivocate. I mean, just like I've made a distinction between blank, sterile nothingness and pregnant nothingness, I think it may seem like nothingness is just a single concept, but I think we have... It's a word that we can equivocate with. We can mean one thing in one assertion and another thing in another assertion and maybe a third thing in another assertion. So we'd have to be really, really careful to define exactly what we mean by nothing and what the implications are before we could even get started talking about Because there are some senses of nothingness that do exist, I think. I mean, like outer space.
Yeah.
Arguably, that's nothingness, but it exists.
It's a kind of nothingness.
It's a kind of nothingness.
So if nothingness, I guess the way that I think of nothingness in our language is the absence of being, like the absence of existence. Mm-hmm. And so is it fair to say that there is no place in reality where there is the absence of being?
I think so.
There's no place in reality where existence doesn't exist.
And by reality, you mean created reality, by, what we would call.
I guess so.
Yeah.
I mean, that's,
yeah, I think there. I think there's no complete absence of being.
Yeah.
If we're, if, because I think Aristotle is right about this, in the sense that there's always the potentiality of being.
Yeah.
And to the extent that that's something and not nothing, yeah, then.
It's a lot of funny terms, but.
So if the potentiality actualizes, mm-hmm. then it's no longer matter.
No, it is. Because substance is when form informs matter. So the potentiality of existence there, it became actualized by tableness and made a table there. Well, in the space that's occupied by this table, when the table wasn't there, there's matter, if you will. And when this table comes to be here, it's because tableness, the form, has informed the pure potentiality, the matter that is there to make a table, a particular table, the substance of a particular table.
Matter is only the potential for something being there, and there is nothing there. Then when it's actualized, doesn't that change the definition? It violates its own definition. And I'm looking at this really simply.
Oh, so you're because did I say the matter still there? Is that what?
No, I'm asking. Well, yes, that's my question.
Okay.
Does matter still exist if the potentiality
has been
filled?
It's been replaced by a substance. I confused you. But okay, I want to wrap this up and then I'll let you go. So notice that a form for Aristotle, and he's very explicit about this, it's not a primary substance, it's a secondary substance. It's not, strictly speaking, a substance itself, because it is not itself an individual, particular, existing thing, for it must exist only in a particular object, that is, a substance or in a mind. So forms are eternal, but they're not eternal substances. So remember we talked about the difference between Plato and Aristotle? That one way to describe the difference between Plato and Aristotle is Plato believed that the forms were primary substances. That is, not only were they eternal, but they existed as distinct, discrete, particular existing things. But Aristotle rejected that. So he's saying, no, they're not substances. But then he has to stop and go, well, but in a sense they're a substance, because it's only by that form informing matter that any substance could possibly exist at all. So the way he describes it is they are a secondary substance. They are not primary substances themselves, but they are a part of or a contributing factor in every substance that is. And so he tries to describe that by calling it the secondary substance. Determining, actually, yeah. Okay, enough Aristotle for one day. You see what he's introducing into the history of ideas is incredible subtlety, incredible sophistication, an incredible mind, and that what makes the medieval scholastic philosophy and theology what it is, the subtlety of distinctions and everything, is just imitating Aristotle. And they're just thinking like Aristotle would think. Okay?